Last week, I spoke to former SES soldier Lindsay Bruce, an amazing episode which really highlighted the key skills and mindset you need to make it into the SES. I love the honesty in this episode. If you haven't already, go check out the episode with Lindsay Bruce now. Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we are joined by S&C coach and hybrid athlete, Jamie Scott. Now, Jamie came to me a few months ago discussing the possibility of him wanting to do a PhD in the area of hybrid training. So I thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity for you to come on the show and we can discuss all of the types of areas that we can look into. In this episode, we discuss the misconceptions around the interference effect, what kind of factors we need to be really focused on when it comes to hybrid research, and he discusses his own experiences as a hybrid athlete and gives us three tips for our hybrid training. As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram, YouTube, and check out all of our other content. Here is Jamie Scott. Before we get started, I wanted to mention The Progress Theory newsletter. Do you want the latest information on how to optimize human physical and mental performance sent straight to your email? Subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack, where you will receive the latest research and recommendations on how to optimize your performance each week. Head to the show notes and click the link where you can sign up today. Don't miss out. Now, let's get into the show. Jamie, welcome to the Progress Theory. How are we?
I'm good, thank you.
Ever since you sent me a message saying you wanted to discuss hybrid training and possibly do it as a PhD, you know, my ears picked up and I was like, that's really cool. I really want to sort of progress that because we've been developing projects at the university regarding hybrid training, you know, moving away from that just concurrent training, maybe looking into certain questions which lead more onto hybrid training, which is obviously getting more and more popular now. So if you actually did the PhD, we were one of the first in that particular area in the country, which I think is really cool. So we can discuss ideas, all sorts of things in this episode.
Yep.
So, yeah, before we get started, do you want to tell the viewers and listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so we know each other through St. Mary's. So I was a student at St. Mary's undergoing the master's program, which was great, had a lot of fun. My sort of research in that was looking at the effects on neuromuscular fatigue through dehydration. So I did that. I run a gym, so a one-to-one performance gym. So we did a one-to-one S&C and small group training in Kingston. And yeah, like in terms of hybrid training, that's just something that I've been doing myself. I think from a kid, like I've always done multiple different sports. I wouldn't say I'm sub-elite. I would say I was kind of average at everything. But yeah, I always play different sports and kind of my training has always kind of mirrored that. So I've always had a lot of variety in my training and I enjoy that variety. So that's why, yeah, kind of hybrid stuff appeals to me. I like focusing on different endeavors and trying to pursue different things at once. And I think it mirrors kind of life really. I think we spoke about it briefly off camera, but you're trying to run a business and do a master's at the same time and, you know, have a successful kind of business and spend time doing that and also have a relationship as well. Like my partner probably goes, oh no, he's spending a bit too much time on the gym and training. But I find it's always a challenge and I quite like that kind of like, how can we develop certain qualities and simultaneously and try to be good at multiple things at once. And it's a real challenge. So yeah.
No, that's cool. It's a really interesting way of putting it because before you get into the weeds of thinking about the compatibility of strength and endurance training, like most people are kind of hybrid anyway, yeah, because exactly. If you're doing training, you're trying to learn a new skill somewhere else in life, and like you're developing a business, you're doing a master's, all these type of different things. So you're always combining different aspects of life which require energy. So how you deviate energy to try and be as good as possible in each one, I think is what sets people apart. And what you said about being average, I've seen your scores. You're better than average. If you're average, I am poor to very poor. I think a lot of people have realized that, hold on, I can train for multiple different things. I've got variety in my training, but I've never really pushed for multiple things to be as good as I could potentially be in multiple things. And people are realizing like, oh, wait a minute, I can actually get pretty good. There isn't anything or some pre-misconception that's stopping me pushing in a certain direction because, if I do that way, I'm going to be really bad at all the other things. And people are starting to realize, actually, if I start to program more appropriately, I can be pretty good. And then we had that post because you mentioned sub-elite, and you mentioned how actually being sub-elite in multiple sports could be more impressive than being elite in one sport. And I certainly think that because, well, we've only got a limited amount of resource as a person. So being very good or sub-elite, which I think a sub-elite would be above very good, is really quite impressive. Someone else commented as well, saying that like they just came third in the like national weightlifting competition, and they're a CrossFit athlete. And it really shows like what kind of level that you can actually achieve in all of these individual sports as a hybrid athlete.
Yeah, like, absolutely. And I think that's why it kind of mirrors like some of those, I said it's changed their life, but I think a phrase that I like is like, we all kind of reach our level of incompetence, right? And it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek commentary on kind of hierarchical systems. So politics and businesses, and you know, you have essentially potentially everyone in an employee structure or a business structure that might reach their level of incompetence at a certain role, and then they would have to specialize and need appropriate skills training or whatever that might be, or more refined recruitment strategies. And I find that very similar to just my experience in business and kind of, you know, as a coach. And then you have this business and you kind of go, oh, bloody hell, like I don't know how to deal with accounts and things like that. And then that's when obviously you outsource if you have the finances to do that, or you allocate more time. And I think that that's the real kind of big thing that I've learned in not only just sport, but in business as well. But, you know, time is one of the most important assets. And ultimately, like, you need more time to be able to focus on some of these things. And that's the biggest limiting factor. So when we talk about hybrid approaches and being sub-elite, like, that fascinates me, because essentially you have people that are in these kind of mismatched conditions or suboptimal conditions inherently, and they're still performing exceptionally well, being able to kind of spin those plates. I think it's fascinating. So yeah, like, I think that when you have an athlete that is maybe not as appreciated because those performances aren't kind of like world class, so you're not going to have like someone run like a sub 10 second 100 meters. But let's say someone's able to run like a sub 11.5 and also able to snatch 130 kilograms, and then even more divergent than that is be able to run like a sub 3 marathon. I think I said it in the post, like, you probably have one of the very select humans on earth. And I think that's fascinating to really appreciate that, actually, from a genetic point of view, but also from the management of time. And also, I think the side note to this, I mentioned kind of my fiance, but she, you know, when people allow or facilitate you to be able to achieve those sort of things, in terms of, again, like, I'm a big believer that I was only able to do the masters and run a business because other areas of my life were kind of, someone was able to be able to support me and kind of prop me up, so to speak. And, you know, I don't like the phrase like, how you do one thing is how you do everything, because like I could barely kind of put my pants on at some occasions. So so whilst I kind of pushed those endeavors and did those quite well, like, there's always someone else kind of propping you up. And yeah, I just find there's a lot of correlation there, and I kind of like talking about that. So
Yeah, it makes you start reflecting on, okay, what do you want to be particularly good at? Let's think of it as, you know, individual sports. And the more you add, the more you bring down that sub-elite level, possibly. Because, like you said, time is possibly the most important factor here. If you can't attribute enough time to get better at it, then you're not going to. And to the point where start to have too many things, it will start bleeding into your training for the other things. So whether you call that an interference effect, possibly, because technically that's what it is. People link the interference effect to some like magic thing which stops something, but really it's just something going a bit overboard on one aspect, which is just interfering the next bit. So like you said, in business, like, you've outsourced certain things, then that energy can then be redirected in focusing on developing another particular skill. And this is where I think CrossFit athletes are really quite impressive, because yes, they've got an amalgamation that's kind of its own sport, but they clearly have to be very good at running, rowing, weightlifting, gymnastics. Like, that's a lot of sports to be very good at. So if you're dividing your time to try and get as good as possible to all of those, you know, that's quite impressive. And the level you're going to get to each one, if you're training them at the same time, it's probably not going to be as high as potentially you could be, but you never really know that, you know, you might have reached that level anyway. I think some people reach their kind of like physiological limit, but they could also reach a different physiological limit in another load of other different sports. So I think it was a conversation I had with Evan Pycom, which he talks about, like, people argue that, oh, you can't be an elite in certain things if you try and be a hybrid athlete as well. A lot of people can't be elite in a lot of things anyway, because they just don't have the genetic potential to be that. So some people probably are genetically predisposed to be very good at a lot of different things. I think the thing that made me think of that was it wasn't the 5K run from the CrossFit Games, was it? It was like a 4.65K run, apparently.
4.5,
but I saw a post which adjusted the times, and they were still running, like, I think it was 18-minute 5Ks, which, if you take into account all of the other stuff they have to do over that stretch of 5 days, that's still pretty impressive. You know, it's not elite, it's not Cheptegei, is it? But but Cheptegei can't snatch 100 to 120 kilos, can he? So it does really make you think.
And I think that, again, like, from it, it's the appreciation of those performances, because, again, like, the, yes, whilst it isn't the absolute elite, I also think that, like, the genetic kind of profile of someone like a Matt Fraser is fascinating, like, because, you know, if you take this kind of general approach, like, I don't know if we know how high that ceiling can be, because it's only really, I mean, general training has been around, GPB stuff's been around for a long, long time, but actually to almost, I mean, it sounds a bit silly, but specialize in GPB, but like kind of maximize your time doing these divergent different skills and whatnot. Like, I don't know if we've kind of, you know, maximized that kind of avenue and kind of really, you know, got more people into that type of training. You know, you see the kind of the carryover in terms of people weightlifting, so going into CrossFit and then competing in weightlifting, so the mass participation increase in numbers in weightlifting is fascinating. So, like you say, it's achieving some very, very good scores. So, yeah, it's just how high does the ceiling go? And I find that fascinating, because then it's the appreciation of maybe those individuals are, again, from a genetic point of view, have a kind of great foundation, have a very sort of high floor, so to speak. And then on top of that is the nature nurture stuff, like the environment has lent themselves, you know, to be able to facilitate more time. And again, like, that comes into what I spoke about just a second ago in terms of people, you know, facilitating you to be able to do stuff. Yeah, like, you have being more predisposed to a certain set of skills and qualities. And yeah, so I find that very interesting. That's something that we just probably don't know how high that ceiling is. And then, like you mentioned about the interference effect, I find that fascinating, because, again, definitely agree that for majority of the people, if you're starting out on this journey of a hybrid approach, then, you know, you can make incredible gains up until you probably do reach that level of, you know, incompetence, so to speak, but where you might have to specialize. But I think, to be honest with you, I don't think I've got there, and I don't think a lot of people get there because of, you know, some of the other factors in terms of time and people's lives, right? Like, you know, if you work a full-time job, you know, or like a, you know, single parent, like, it's super hard anyway. Like, you can't, you're never going to maximize that genetic ceiling anyway. So, yeah, it's very interesting. So that's why I'm sort of fascinated by it.
What's your opinion on the interference effect and its interpretation? And I ask that because if you look at the definition as it is, if you just look at it, the interference effect is anything that interferes with it. So clearly, like we've discussed, when we think of an interference effect, clearly there's so many different factors that come under that umbrella of what an interference effect is. But I guess originally a lot of people did think it was some kind of physiological process that means that, oh, if you train in endurance training, it's going to completely ruin your strength gains, for example. Where do you think we have, or as a community, the interference effect has been misinterpreted?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that research from the molecular point of view, that's kind of obviously where its origins were. I think that for me, the elephant in the room of all this stuff is the management of training load. Like I think that if you think about that, I always frame training to be, when you look at the effects and responses to, you know, training and fatigue, so fatigue accumulated from performing a certain bout of training, like, we have to consider that the training stress we're laying on top of your environment, right? And I think that, like, we're very good at maybe looking at isolating those mechanisms, because we can measure them. Like, we, you know, in my study, for example, with Baz, like, you know, we looked at the consequence of dehydration having an impact on voluntary activation, so the ability for the, you know, motor cortex to send a message and contract the muscle, you know, as maximally as it can. And like we saw a decrement, and we saw a decrement for a couple of hours, and then it returned to baseline. That was 5% dehydration. It's quite a, you know, an intense, it's 3 hours of cycling in 45 degree heat, and over, you know, 2 hours, a person was able to, you know, return to somewhat their baseline. So,
were you a participant as well?
Yeah, I went for it, and so it's a 3 hours dehydration, 45 degree heat, very very light cycling. So we used like exercise induced way of.
Did you wear the suit to sweat?
No, I didn't. No, there's some interesting kind of physiology with that, and my understanding of some of that, the sweat rate stuff, and it's maybe not as good as NADS, but we just chose to keep it simple. You know, just some clothes, 45 degree heat, make sure there wasn't too much humidity, some more dry heat. And then we did a pre and post, and then 2 hours post, and then, you know, with rehydration, rapid rehydration, and then sort of slow sort of taper rehydration, just seeing the effects of dehydration in itself, but also types of rehydration strategies. So more looking at the effects for combat sports athletes. That's what we were trying to sort of look at as an overview picture. What was interesting is that when you look at potentially the reasons for fatigue, from a peripheral perspective, from a central perspective, even like the desire to drink might downregulate your force production, for example, because that's your primary need. That's the thing that disturbs homeostasis, right? You're sort of sitting there with a participant and we're going, we'll give you a drink in a second. We just got to get this test done. And, you could see that people are getting irritable. You could see their mood. We did some mood scores as well. And you could see that people, why would they want to contract their quadriceps as maximally as possible when they just really want to drink? So, and obviously that then has an impact on obviously the downregulation force and the neural drive and whatnot. And then within that, we didn't do peripheral markers, but you can look at, I guess, from TMS, like half relaxation rate. Ultimately, I came away from looking at that and thinking, well, there's so many factors that influence essentially your performance, and that might not always be the same every time that you go out for a run or a cycle. That isn't impacted from some basic physiological needs. And I think Jerome Dempsey spoke about like physiological redundancy, essentially like systems within systems. And ultimately you need to stay alive, and it doesn't really care about your 5K time or whatever. And so things happen that you're probably not even aware of in terms of weighing, trying to make sure that you kind of keep the trains on the track, so to speak. And things will be kind of taken from one area to another and adjusted just so you can kind of keep performing. And I think that kind of really opened my eyes up to kind of that integration in terms of physiology. And I kind of described it as like a fractal image, so to speak, or you look at it and you see this kind of complex phenomenon, and you zoom in a little bit more and you see the same image, but maybe a little bit more nuance and detail. And I think that was a great way that the way that I looked at it. When you think about all this stuff and you think about the interference effect, then, well, what's the bigger picture? If someone, again, has got a really busy life and, they're stressed at work and in a difficult relationship and they're sleeping 3 hours a night, what are we really measuring? What's the bigger factor that we need to kind of measure? And I think if everyone kind of gets, this is why research is so difficult as well, because if we isolate, have a cohort of people and we're really, super refined and making sure that everyone's got appropriate sleep, nutrition, and that's very difficult to do anyway. But if you can do that, perhaps you can try to see the real impact of some of those physiological mechanisms in terms of is there, we know there's maybe a competing adaptation. So even stuff like fast twitch fibers, I think we'll probably get onto this anyway, but it's like twitch fibers. So, we know that the contraction and relaxation rate of fast switch fibers are obviously fast, and slow switch is slow. So those adaptations based on the type of training that you're doing, and then the differences between people in terms of 10% and 70% variance in your intermediate fibers, that throws a big curveball in the study anyway, because you'd have different people with different kind of thresholds of that, and that might result in different effects of performance. So I just think when it comes to interference effect, I think it's a rabbit hole. And I think, again, ultimately, you can reach a really high level and be very, very, very successful in multiple disciplines if the factors outside training are well kept. If you're recovering well, if you're sleeping well, eating well, you could probably reach an extremely high level. And then maybe at the 1%, maybe at the really high training volumes, that's where we might see some interference, I guess. I hope that kind of summarizes my thoughts on it, but yeah.
No, it's cool to hear. And I agree in terms of that 1%. There was a particular schematic which looks at the level of, not a level of interference, but the rate of improvement. And it's pretty much the same in novice athletes. And the more elite you go, the more it sort of separates away. And there was a section for the moderate athlete. And I'm thinking, I think the moderate athletes are very, very similar to the novice athletes. Like with the, if you're taking into account all those different factors, yes, training and manipulation of training load, volumes, intensity, all that type of thing, but also your outside lifestyle factors. Like there's nothing to say that you couldn't improve at a very similar rate versus someone that is working at a single sport for a moderate athlete. Yep. It's really the people that reach that sub-elite, that elite level where, yeah, their training is, the volumes of training are so large, then all of a sudden their training can really start to overlap because, you know, they're doing more and they also have to reach a higher intensity to drive that adaptation. Yep. So if we've all got our own limited bucket of energy, you know, that's going to use up a lot more. Yeah, if you're an elite athlete and you're that bucket of energy, a lot of it's been taken up by your training, like it shows how much more detrimental poor sleep could be to that person. Whereas if you are only training one day, 5 days a week for an hour, you could probably get away with a little bit of poor sleep because your training volumes and intensities aren't going to be as high. You're not that level of elite for it to actually be that much of an effect. So yeah, all these different factors all have different varying effects based on what's going on everywhere. So
yeah,
but it's cool to just discuss that because there really does seem to be some kind of misconception that's slowly going away, especially if you're looking at Instagram or anything like that. And people that are perpetuating the old misconception are probably doing it to try and gain attention, or they are, I don't know, they're probably trying to sell something, to be honest. They're using something which they think is going to gather attention towards that. So it's cool to see that we're getting a better understanding of what it is, because as soon as you get rid of those misconceptions, our perception of how far we can go will change, and that ultimately will change how far we can go in hybrid training. Because, I mean, I was writing a chapter in my book recently, and I need to do a little bit of an addition to one of the chapters regarding the future of the research. Because, we know some stuff from what's been done before. Clearly, it doesn't necessarily match what is going on in the CrossFit and the hybrid space. So, you know, what we thought could generate some form of interference effect in terms of, like, I don't know, order of sessions or time recovery between sessions, I think that will really change. I mean, you even said in your study with Naz, like, it was 2 hours before people returned to baseline after providing some really intense intervention where they had to get a 5% dehydration. And if they recovered in 2 hours, a usual training session which you're a bit more accustomed to, you're probably going to recover really quickly after that. So wonder people are doing these like 5 hour days of training. Over time it might be a bit detrimental, but you know, again, there's a lot of different factors involved here.
I think that just on that as well, it's not saying that there's always a better way to program, right? I think no one's arguing that in terms of, like, necessarily. I always kind of put it on a scale of appropriateness. I think that's a good way to view the way that you'd have like a training intervention. You look at a scale of appropriateness and say, well, is it something more appropriate or less appropriate? And then you base that on some of what we spoke about there in terms of where you're placing certain sessions, some of the mechanisms of our understanding behind why a heavy strength session might impair like a threshold session, for example. And I think you had a great podcast on that, and that was Dr. Kenji Doma, am I correct? So that was great. And obviously, I don't think anyone argues that these things happen. It's just the degree to which they happen. Again, the familiarity, the environment you're laying that training stress on top of. And again, if we're seeing people that are, from a voluntary activation, so as a marker of central fatigue, if we're seeing people being able to recover after some pretty severe dehydration, so 5%, I think that we just have to be careful with maybe reading too much into those mechanistic variables. And I think that the idea that people in general probably just have to train a bit more, right? We just have to increase, we have to get people out training, we have to get people moving. And I think that, there's this idea about, maybe overdoing it or pushing it or overtraining and managing fatigue. I think the bigger factors are, okay, are you sleeping well? Are you well fed? Like, you're not in a low energy availability. Like, and if you look at, just speaking about some of the people I train, some endurance athletes and just general pop clients, like, they have busy, stressful lives, and but they, they train in a concurrent fashion. They might have different, hybrid goals in terms of, as well, in terms of like, okay, I want to get stronger and I also want to run a 5K. And they do that. So, and like, it's just, like you say, when there's high volumes, when there's a lot of time accumulated, I think that that's when we probably have to be even more appropriate with the way that we plan our training. And we have to be more appropriate with how we're recovering and resting and fueling for activity. And I think that's where we're seeing maybe some of those interference effects, but actually it might just be a management of training load. And then, competing for adaptations. And I think that, that stuff in terms of the example of the fast switch, slow switch, not to condense physical performance into fast and slow switch, but like, you might see that competition for those adaptations with both high volumes and high intensities of workload. So,
I'm just going to interrupt here to quickly thank our sponsors. Hydrate by Human24. Hydrate is a fast and effective formula to improve hydration by replacing fluid and body salts after an intense training session or after a long night's sleep. Each sachet contains an optimal ratio of sodium, potassium, and magnesium to improve cellular hydration. I highly recommend the citrus flavor, which I always take immediately upon waking. It really sets my day up perfectly. Head to human24.com, that's HMN24.com, where you can get a month's supply of 30 sachets and use the code FILL10 at checkout for 10% off. Now, let's get back into the conversation. Where do you think the hybrid training research needs to go? What don't we know that's been investigated before? I guess more towards the concurrent training end. Hypertraining, I guess, is concurrent training, but now people are going to start competing in, powerlifting and a triathlon. Like, people are creating their own hybrid challenges, and we're seeing some incredible things. To supplement that, or to either show what has already been done in the training space, where do you think the research needs to go?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that's kind of, when I reached out to you and sort of asked you the sort of same question in terms of, what are the possibilities there in terms of how do we improve on that space and understanding of hybrid training? And I think that, like we spoke about the interference effect, I think that's well plowed as a topic, but it is understood in a sense of some of the molecular mechanisms. You extrapolate that to training, and then it's obviously really good training studies, but that's inherently very difficult, as is some of the stuff that we've already mentioned. So I guess it's probably my answer, but I would say really good training studies are important. Longer term, training studies and interventions, I think that most training studies are 8 to 12 weeks, and that's a problem. Because a lot of the time, especially with stuff like, when you match like HIIT training, endurance training, and strength training, the intensity dictates the magnitude of the response. And so if you've got, someone that is doing a certain amount of training and you give them this new stimulus, then yes, you're going to see these changes. I think that we just need some longer training studies, kind of seeing the development of both qualities. And then maybe some more understanding about the ideas that I think we spoke briefly about, the differences between maybe cycling and running from a fatigue perspective, and maybe more centrally fatiguing from running due to the kind of neuromuscular demand versus maybe peripheral from the cycling. So that, that's kind of there. I know there's a few studies out there, but that's probably my answer, I guess, is exploring and maybe having, that process. Hopefully we'll get to some better questions as you start to, have more research, and hopefully, you can get to a better place with that, and have better questions to answer. But I think the one thing that I would say on that, it's really important about the type of population that you've got in your kind of cohort in your study, because I think, again, like, if you have people that are very novice to training, no one can argue, like, by doing, a couple of you know, endurance sessions will also increase their ability to produce force through the floor, right? If they're on a bike or running, if your kind of baseline is very low. So I think that it's really to distinguish the mechanisms and then have someone that is a level where they're well strength trained, but also well endurance trained, and then to see if those improvements rise simultaneously based on whatever intervention you have. Just really distinguishing the two, does that make sense? Because I think sometimes, like, we look at kind of most of it's untrained subjects or moderately trained subjects. I mean, well, what really is that? And okay, if you give a moderately trained subject consistent interval training or whatever, like, you're going to see a response, and you're probably seeing an adaptation to strength as well, right? So, you know, wherever you small or whatever. So, yeah.
It highlights potential areas where we need to know a little bit more. I mean, certainly with the running versus cycling debate, a lot of where that has come from is from meta-analyses, which have shown that if some form of interference effect, or however they've defined that, has happened, it's usually because they've chosen running over cycling as the endurance component. So it's like, well, why is that? So, you know, they're associating that or speculating that because of the different mechanisms around fatigue, you know, central versus peripheral, which is fine. But, you know, we could probably do more to understand the mechanisms behind it. And we definitely need to do more to understand, okay, well, we're going to generate fatigue there. Well, what happens next? If I did something later, how would that be affected by that type of fatigue? Like, I don't think that's really been looked at. So fatigue is a real key one. I mean, the level of participants, like you described, I think is really key, but so difficult to find, because if they are at that level, they're already doing some form of structured training. And if you try and take them away to do a specific, I guess it would be a generic one, because you're creating two groups, they're not going to like that. So you're always trying to bring in people which end up being, well, they call them recreationally trained, isn't it? Where it's usually people around the university, let's be honest. You said, you know, you do some training with them and they just get better with whatever you do with them. They're difficult to do, but they're so necessary, because anyone that's using the argument of the interference effects doesn't exist, or this, that, and the other, is usually because they're utilizing research which have used novice to moderately trained subjects, which is, I think, warping our idea of what's actually really going on. It'd be good to run this by you, because I've always thought that one of the most important things to do for a hybrid athlete is to progress slowly. So if we've got someone that's progressing in a single sport, let's say it's powerlifting, versus a hybrid athlete, the hybrid athlete would increase at a level week by week. The gradient wouldn't be as steep. You know, the increase would be less. To me, that isn't a bad thing, because you're trying to develop two things at the same rate. So your rate of improvement is going to be not as extreme. Whereas if you only focus on one thing, you know, that gradient of improvement is going to be greater, especially in the first 8 weeks. And then to really prove my point where taking it slowly is going to be more beneficial, I reckon if you had this accelerated development in a single sport, you know, by the time you get to that 8 week, 12 week period, they're going to start to plateau off unless you make some drastic changes. Whereas I think if you've programmed things correctly, the hybrid athlete is just going to steadily get better and better. So if you'd move that from 12 weeks to 24 weeks, their strength might have caught up. But we've got nothing to really show that, apart from probably some anecdotal evidence from people collecting, which I still think is really quite important to bring into the argument. So it'd be, like you said, the length of the training interventions are really important, but they're so hard to do and control.
Yeah. And absolutely, I think that study you just mentioned there, again, if you can extrapolate that out for longer time periods, is fascinating. Because again, I think we see that a consistent application of a training stimulus, right? We know that over time, specifically for more novice individuals, that it just has to be consistent and they'll see adaptations, right? You don't have to do anything progressive overload, but you just have to, because that in of itself, it always makes me laugh when people talk about, you know, they're starting like a weight training routine. It's like, okay, how do I progress next week? It's like, well, like, just hang on a second. Like, just by you doing something is already progressive overload, right? By having consistent training stimulus. So
next week should feel easier.
Yeah, exactly.
If you did the same thing, next week should feel easier.
Exactly. And I think that's really interesting because usually what happens is, you know, again, if you do program it appropriately, people start to feel better. They start to feel stronger. And then over time, okay, you might tweak that. And, you know, I think strength training, maybe I kind of wrote a blog post talking about endurance training, like time accumulated is the most important thing.
And
if you look at elite endurance athletes, like everyone is producing a lot of hours doing their sport, right? And that was kind of getting into the debate about, is zone two necessarily special, or is it just the fact that it manages fatigue really well in terms of, like, it's not high enough intensity to accumulate fatigue, but it means that I can spend more time signaling for adaptations. And so, you know, economy, efficiency, and to some of those aerobic adaptations, I think is it Andy Coogan's chart of adaptations or strength of adaptations across intensities and zones. I think that was the chart. But for most of the, you know, adaptations, like, you know, improve VO2 max, improve mitochondrial density, biogenesis, and, you know, blood flow to working muscles, like, you have to start working hard. It has to be an increase in intensity. We see that a stronger signal of adaptations gets sent, and hence why interval training is so powerful, right? Because by now enabling rest, we're enabled to spend more time at high intensity, but the cost of that is more fatigue. So that kind of chart, where we understand that, okay, the strength of the signal is greater for higher intensity work, but we know that we can't always do high intensity work because of the cost of fatigue. So we have to spend more time in these kind of sub-maximal zones, in zone one, zone two, where it's enough to signal adaptation, but I'm just spending loads of time there. So is it anything inherently special about the zone two, or is it just, you know, the fact that we're able to spend more time there and keep fresh some of our hot sessions? You know, I kind of see it as two kind of almost like two ends of the spectrum. It's like time spent signaling for adaptations and then strength of adaptations, and just making sure that there are, you know, from a fatigue management perspective, like we're dabbling in, you know, a high potency in terms of a high threshold stimulus and all that sort of stuff, and making sure that we've got the time practicing our sport. And I think in terms of that, it's CrossFit as well. Like for me, when I was doing CrossFit years ago, everything was intense because I was seeing return on investment when I started, right? And I think that's a lot of people see. They go, okay, I'm feeling good, feeling strong. I'm just going to keep layering those intense sessions. I'm going to keep doing those Metcons, those workouts of the day. And in actuality, that's not what CrossFit athletes do these days. Like, they don't do the typical kind of workout of the day. Actually, you know, they have their strength and then they have some aerobic sessions, and then they'll do the sport-specific work, and they'll kind of put those hot sessions in and enable for recovery the next day. And then again, so I think that this is going back to kind of our original point. I'll kind of go off on a tangent then, but like looking at when someone starts to get better, you have the question of, okay, and to improve this, I can add intensity and keep time the same, but we're going to reach a ceiling with that quite quickly, probably. Or do we add time? But then it's up to you if you've got the time to do that. And that's the problem most people have. Like I say, going back to kind of the first point. But ultimately, we have to add time if we're going to get closer to our sort of genetic ceiling. And that's when the discussion comes into play. Okay, our sessions have to be more appropriate. Like our zone two sessions or our endurance sessions have to be truly, you know, at a pace that is not accumulating too much fatigue. And I think that's where people kind of go wrong, is that they're adding this intensity and then, like, okay, I'm going to slow down a little bit, but it's just not enough because you've doubled your time, for example. So like you've still got this kind of high potency stimulus signaling for these kind of aerobic adaptations or whatnot, but you also, you know, are spending a lot of time there. So you kind of hit this kind of roadblock where, you know, I think I read the other day that Kipchoge's like slow paces is like, yeah, but 5 minute per kilometer. The reason why he can do that is because he's got such high volumes of time. But for someone that's got 4 hours a week, like you probably, you should leverage a bit more intensity. But again, you just got to make sure that as you add more time, that it's appropriate for, you know, your recovery needs and their net. So yeah, it's just hard, but because if you scale that to training and studies, like that's really difficult because, you know, you've got everyone individually responding to the stimulus in a different rate based on some of the stuff we spoke about. And it just makes training stuff studies really, really difficult. But I do think that it has to be a lot more longer, you know, intervention and just looking at people over time. Yeah, a bit of a tangent there, but like I just find that an interesting topic in terms of just time and how that's different for different people and the constraints that people have. And why things adjust from maybe a more potent stimulus to a lesser potent stimulus and the benefits that we see. So, yeah.
Speaking of you as the athlete.
Yep.
What are your hybrid goals and what are you currently training for? It'd be interesting to see that, you know, you've got all these ideas. How are you implementing them into your own training to achieve what you want to achieve?
I think probably like quite a lot of people in lockdown sort of started to run. And, you know, I just started enjoying being outdoors. And, you know, I wasn't really much of a runner beforehand, although, you know, obviously playing different sports. But I started to enjoy that and also cycling as well. I'm quite lucky. I live very close to Richmond Park. So, like, I've got a lovely kind of... It's not really called a racetrack, but some people act like it is. But it's a lovely place to cycle. So I enjoy those two sports. And so I have a duathlon coming up in September.
Where is that?
That's Richmond Park. So that's just
Richmond Park. Okay.
Yeah, so that's the course essentially. So they close it down. It's a 10K run, a 44K bike, and a 5K run at the end. So in terms of the strength stuff, I'm a big sort of gymnastics fan. Like years ago when I did CrossFit, that was always something that I enjoyed doing, you know, from a muscle up stuff. And even years and years ago when I was younger, I had a pair of gymnastic rings that have lasted me a long, long time. So I always enjoy that type of training. So over the last sort of couple of months, specifically been working towards like some like heavier weighted muscle up stuff, progressions towards like an iron cross, even though like I don't think I'll ever get there. I've got two longer limbs, but that's a dream of mine to be able to achieve that. But
you're about as tall as me. How tall are you?
Yeah, so I'm 6'1". So like, I don't think it's. I mean, who knows? I mean, there are some certainly some gymnasts out there that can achieve that. And I'm sort of within, you know, sort of there's ways to train it. It's so like an iron cross trainer where you just shorten the lever a little bit, so kind of work out and out. And I think Coach Summer, the US gymnastics coach, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but he said like you progress like an inch every year. So like I'm about like, you know, a couple of inches away from my wrist, so another 4 years and I'll get there. So from a tendon perspective, like you just have to be very careful with, again, the way that you, from a dose response and the management of that, from a, again, like super stressful movements, a lot of straight arm work, and that kind of sometimes beats up the tendons a little bit. And yeah, management of that, along with, you know, the endurance side of it, and then also weightlifting. So I think that when we spoke about this sort of episode, having a chat, like if we were to pick two sports that would be really difficult or challenging to improve based on those kind of different environments, it would be high rate of force development, like again the neural component. So, you know, weightlifting, so producing force in 500 milliseconds versus then also trying to improve like your Ironman time, for example. For me, like I'm in the complete opposite end of the spectrum, and the qualities are very divergent. So, like, the interesting thing that I probably would say from an anecdotal perspective is that when I have done weightlifting, so I particularly enjoy sort of the snatch stuff, like I definitely feel like I have to be very, very sensible in where I place that session, because if I have a little bit of fatigue or whatever, I just don't feel like I've got that kind of snap and kind of neural drive and whatnot. So, yeah, that, again, is that just management of fatigue? Is that actually because I've made some adaptations and more biased that endurance side of things, and my weightlifting isn't as maybe consistent, because it probably isn't consistent as a stimulus, so it's hard to say. But I think from what we know about the literature, that does seem to be the thing that is attenuated a little bit, is the high rate of force development stuff. Yeah, so I don't know what you think about that, but that's...
No, I'd be really impressed. If you really went for, you know, like a weightlifting total plus a really good Ironman time, like you have to put so much training in to be good at Ironman. Or Ironman distance, sorry. I need to say Ironman distance triathlon, don't I? And then you add in a lot of strength training to improve in that strength sport. Not strength training to improve in Ironman, but strength training to also improve at a strength sport. And then have that strength sport be something which needs a certain amount of neuromuscular readiness, which often isn't available because of all the other training that you're doing. You know, that shows just how, I would have said those are my two that I think would be particularly challenging. I'd almost argue that weightlifting plus Ironman distance triathlon would be more difficult than weightlifting plus 100K ultra marathon, for example, just because you've got the cycling component, you've got the swimming component, you've got two other movements where you need to be very proficient and efficient at, and that takes a lot of time to develop, a lot of time, like you described. So that's what makes it very, very different. And obviously on the bike, you need to be very efficient and strong in a very different, even though you're going through triple extension of the lower limb, it's still a very different position to generate force from. So you need to be good there as well, which people argue you're going to a deep catch, there's some dynamic correspondence there, but they're still very different in terms of the muscular contractions to perform both of those things. So yeah, I would have put those two together as the difficult ones. So if you're going for that, I'm going to sit back with my popcorn and and watch to see how you improve there, prove everyone wrong, show that you can do it and hit really good times.
Yeah, that's something that it's just from a pure experiment perspective, that's interesting. But yeah, again, the management of time. Is that a true experiment if I'm not kind of like man off my feet with business or whatever, or in terms of not getting up, small kind of sleep, so to speak, or spending enough time sleep? Like, it's always hard, isn't it, in terms of having those goals and trying to develop them simultaneously. But I think what's interesting about the Ironman distance as well, like you said about the skills and from just experience and just discussing with other people, the swimming specifically is very interesting, because to be efficient and I don't know if you've ever watched any Lionel Sanders videos, but he's a elite world-class triathlon and Ironman distance, but he talks about how he just tried to muscle through swimming and kind of just apply the same mentality as he did for his bike and his run, and just realized that he was just getting beat up because he was pushing himself so hard because he was trying to muscle through it and not understanding perhaps the time spent. And I think that's really interesting when you look at the literature in swimming. If you look at the training volumes, it's an incredibly high amount of training volumes elite swimmers do. You could argue, there's some research out there discussing about whether that is maybe just tradition led in terms of because we don't swim around and we're not all kind of mermaids, you need to spend time in the water and just build up your economy and efficiency and skill. And so coaches, spend a couple of hours in the morning, a couple of hours in the evening, and then, do lots and lots of high meters, across the week. And, for a 400 meter event, if you're doing 50,000 meters a week for 400, I always find it very interesting. If you were to match that for other endurance disciplines, you'd be pretty beat up very quickly, right? So when it comes to Ironman distance, having, trying to map out how can you improve skill on the bike and swimming and also running as well, but specifically swimming, and how do you manage that time in the pool to be good, to be efficient and economical, and making sure that you don't kind of that doesn't ruin your day, so to speak, because that's the first thing that you do. That's fascinating. So that's even discussions that we've had previously about where would you place those kind of skill acquisition sessions. I think it's a big thing for CrossFit as well, because I definitely didn't, when I was doing CrossFit years and years ago, I didn't appreciate the importance of skill, acquisition sessions, actually having it might be a high mental load, but we're going to just focus on just movement and just trying to improve efficiency of a certain task, and not necessarily have to kill myself in doing that task whilst also practicing it, if that makes sense. So I think it's the same with swimming. I would approach it in a very similar way where, yes, still spend time practicing the skill, but making sure that we're not accumulating loads of volume and we're doing things that are potentially that kind of impact some of the other stuff outside the pool. So you're cycling, you're running, and also then you're weightlifting. So, and there's many ways you can do that. I know you've spoken about sort of pre-fatigue as well, and in previous podcasts, and that being quite a common thing that people use and leverage. But yeah, it's interesting. So those two for me would be a real challenge. And I think that's the two opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of human performance, really. So
to nicely round out the episode, it'd be great to hear, what would your main tips be for anyone that wants to reach that next level in hybrid training? Like, you've talked about hot sessions, you've talked about how to, the importance of time. But if you had to, like, say, let's say three, what are the three main tips you think you'd give someone to improve their hybrid performance?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because I think that's probably the most asked, and that, again, you can take that kind of home with them. And I think that for me, it's like, I think I'm a big believer in kind of minimal effective dose to begin with, right? And I think that when you're, again, you're trying to pursue different avenues, I think, I some of the podcasts I've heard you talk about as well, I think it was Fergus probably talking about, like, if you've got two programs, 100% weightlifting, 100% endurance, and you mash them together, like, you have a bit of a problem there. So it, you know, it makes sense to start with a very minimal effective dose. And again, like, get to grips with stuff like RPE, get to grips with stuff like, you know, monitoring your responses to a training stimulus, because, and just seeing how you feel, because ultimately that's going to enable you to do more, and it's going to enable you to be more consistent. It's going to enable you to maybe scale the habit, so to speak. And I think when you come back to the discussion about time, you need to, accumulating time, as long as you've got that availability there, but that's super important. You can't do that if you're feeling beaten up all the time. So the stuff around like minimal effective dose, yeah, for me, when I started running, for example, like, you know, I did one session a week for probably about 6 months. And then I added another session in that was a little bit more intense. And that, so that first session was very, very steady. I was still doing strength training as well. And I was then also spending time on the bike. So I think that, come on, maybe the second part to that in a second. But again, like, my exposure to running was very low for a good few years. So just for me, just getting out there and moving, I'm not really concerned about the time, just accumulating a bit of volume and not necessarily really pushing myself, and just, yeah, getting used to the skill, so just be...
time on feet.
Yeah, exactly, time on feet and just getting comfortable. So, and that's obviously dependent on your start point, you know, and where you are, but, and that, so it only differs really in kind of total time, but yeah, like ultimately just an exposure, but not really, you know, comfortable RPE. And I think that's sometimes difficult with running, because you might have to have a bit of an ego check and go, actually, you know, I feel like I'm not really running that fast, but actually, if I do push it, I'm kind of like, oh, I'm suffering here. My RP is like 8, 9, 10, even though like I'm running. So there was a few times when, again, I took it really easy, and I felt like a trot and a jog, and that's totally okay. So I think I advise people that to spend some time with that, and then what you, again, you'll see some improvements, even just off of that minimal effective dose, like I did. Again, with other training there, I should add. And then, again, I started to add a sort of a higher intensity session. So as things started to feel easier, and a good way to kind of measure that is RPE, is also, you know, you're equating your heart rate for a given workload. So, for example, yeah, I think in a couple of months, like the same heart rate or the same speed, my heart rate was lower. So that was just a marker, again, of like, you know, am I kind of adapting to this sort of pace. And then, yeah, like I said, I started to add a little bit more. And that's actually when I decided, okay, I want to do a half marathon, just kind of see where I'm at. So my time in the half marathon was 1 hour, 29 minutes. And that was off two runs a week. So which goes against all kind of running programs. If you type in running program for a half marathon on the internet, you'll get like five times a week. For that time, obviously, like, again, that was my target. But you'll get like, you know, five times a week running, and it's like you don't have to run to see benefits in running performance if you have other training stimulus there as well. And I think that's the caveat is that, yes, I was still strength training, so it's important that there is training stress there in other departments. But yeah, like, so that was, so for me, again, like that minimal effective dose and just kind of a, you know, being sensible about that and using RPE, using like these measures of progression and adaptation and whatnot. And then, yeah, like, I think that the second, maybe, or, you know, I probably kind of combined this into one kind of tip, I guess, but like the effects of other trainers, so like, I commute on my bike to work, even though it's, you know, 10 to 15 minutes there, so in one way, so 30 minutes total, sort of per day on my bike. Like, I think the structural adaptations or the consistency of that improved my performance massively from an aerobic standpoint, and also from a, again, it wasn't that fatiguing unless I'm running really late. Like, I have to put 250 volts through the pedals because I'm running late. Most of it was always sort of quite easy. but the benefit that has from a structural point of view, like if you had, for example, like a high VO2 max in a certain, you know, endurance sport and you transfer to another endurance sport, you're suddenly not going to have like a really crappy VO2 max, right? You still got those structural adaptations. So yeah, it's just important you have some of these other training stress, plan out the week. And then if you have these kind of hybrid targets, like, okay, start with this minimal effective dose, and then RP is a great way to expose you to that. Yeah, and then it comes back to maybe time. It's like to figure out where that is best placed across your week. And as training, as I maybe increase more time, I have to be more appropriate with my decisions around training and where that's placed. So yeah, and again, RP is a great way of doing that. That's a great way to at least measure responses and, you know, other stuff in terms of management of stresses. So yeah, is that kind of, I guess that's kind of points put together, but yeah, that's just my own experience. And people, when I coach other people, I definitely sort of start with that as the base, and then just depend on their kind of start point, that might look different for different people. So yeah.
Nicely summarized, and definitely stuff that people can take away and utilize themselves, or if they're already doing things like, you know, structuring their training to have some form of minimal effective dose, especially with the high intensity stuff, or they're utilizing ratings of perceived exertion as a form of measuring the intent, or not measuring, it's determining the intensity of their session. Good to like say, oh, like people are recommending that, let me try and utilize it a bit more, become more familiar with, you know, okay, that's a particular intensity. I'd say that's RP7. Like, start asking yourselves why. What is it about how you're physiologically feeling which is making you think it's a 7? All of those types of things is only going to improve your knowledge about how you perform and respond to training over time. So, no, really, yeah. Nice. No, thank you very much, Jeremy. How can anyone find you on social media? Because you've got a few blog posts which people should really check out.
Yeah, so my blog posts are on the gym's website. So that's my business. So that's permaperformance.com. And yeah, just through Instagram and on both sides. So permaperformance, Instagram, and also Jamie_SNC, I believe it is, on my Instagram. So yeah, like those are the best places to find me, or shoot me like a message, or yeah, that's the best place. So.
Ah, cool. Anyone recommend, if you have any questions or anything you want to follow up on from this particular episode, yeah, just send them a message. You're always very forthcoming with your time. That seems to be the theme of this episode, isn't it? It's time, the importance of time and its different forms. So
Cool. cheers for having me on as well. It's been always, I enjoy this sort of content as well, like conversational stuff. I think it's important in trying to communicate ideas, and at the end of the day, like, some of this stuff is, you know, a little bit of trial and error and practice, and I think that, yeah, to hear different opinions, I think like these platforms are fantastic for that. And yeah, so yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. And thank you. It's always cool to talk about hybrid training, because, you know, it's still a very much a form of training and or sport that's in its infancy, both in terms of competitiveness and around the research around it. So exciting times ahead. We'll see what happens over the next decade, I think. Next week, I will be speaking to physiologist, lecturer, and obstacle course racer, Dr. Becky Neal. We will be discussing her amazing research, which involved athletes, including herself, compete in the world's highest OCR. If you love training and adventure, you need to tune in. Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.